Minds, let's jump in. We are going to talk about mechitza today. This is the last class. We'll be talking about the structure of shul, and then future classes we'll be talking more about the different halachos of tefillah, of davening itself. Okay, so with that, let's jump in. I'll begin with a quote from Dr. Jonathan Sarna. He is a wonderful historian who focuses on Jewish history, and he begins with a nice quote, which really sums up some of the tension around mechitza. It says, behind wearisome debates over how sanctuary seats should be arranged and allocated lie fundamental disagreements over the kinds of social and religious values that the synagogue should project, and the relationship between the synagogue and the larger society that surrounds it. Where people sit reveals much about what they believe. And it's such a nicely framed quote, because our seating in shul place is such a representation of our belief system, quite often, that out of everything that takes place in shul, you know, whether it's mixed seating, whether it's a different sizes of mechitza, you could walk into a room and with that be able to tell a whole lot, maybe be a little, you know, that there's a good amount of assessment, even with no one's in the room, just looking at the structure of a shul. You could tell so much. I remember once we had a speaker here, and she walked into the shul, she said, it was built in the 50s. And she was right. There's a certain ideology and certain philosophy that is represented. Obviously, things change, things shift, but there's a lot that goes in, and that's because the seating could be so representative of the values of the shul. Because of that, it becomes quite a tense and emotional topic.
Would this also apply to Sephardic shuls? Or are they more homogeneous?
Typically, there is more, you know, and what we find is that Sephardim are more traditional, even if they aren't necessarily observant in that way. And so some of the tension that we find regarding mixed seating, mechitzas, you don't find the same tension in Sephardic circles, typically, yes. Right. It was done in a certain era, and you have a certain feel. That's right. It's interesting. So actually, someone told me.
They're all the same.
Right. The structure.
Some are fancier than others.
Right. Yeah, you find this tension. Right. This tension doesn't exist. Although I will say, you know, today we're going to do something a little different than we normally do. We're going to go through a little history. So in the context of history, I'll add one thing that's not over here. Someone's supposed to send me a picture of this, but there's a painting from, I think it's like the 1500s, from Amsterdam. Amsterdam actually had a tremendously large Sephardic community. Many people were escaping Spain at the time. And there is a picture from a drawing from that time where there is a shul where there is clearly no mechitza, and there are women who are part of the procession with the Torah, I don't know exactly, and you have to always wonder, like, is this a depiction of reality? I don't know, but it's a fascinating picture. You're supposed to send me a copy of it. But that said, we don't actually have a whole lot of literature about mechitzos up until the past 200 years. Okay, the reason for that is that for most shuls, depends where you were. In Eastern Europe, there was no woman's section. Or if there was, it was like an adjacent room with a little window maybe, you know, with bars. Sorry?
Like a
Meir Sharm, right? Maybe you had some bars, you know, looked like a jail. Like it was this little side room where you were off to the side, and there was no discussion. This was the reality. Many women didn't go to shul. That was also the reality. And even when they started building more beautiful edifices, many of the shuls, it was the standard where there was this balcony, there was less tension around, okay? It's only in the past 200 years, and this is where we're going to get into some of the history over here, because it does play a role actually even in halacha, and it's fascinating. But if you look at the early years of the Reform movement in Germany, right? Germany is where the Reform movement really took off. So for the first 100 years or so, 1800s, throughout, you know, from the 19th century, there was no mixed seating in the Reform shuls. Not at all. Okay. Now they point out, why is that? The theory, and you'll see that this is likely the case, is that the main churches in Germany also didn't have mixed seating. Okay, right? One of the big movements, one of the big pushes from the Reform movement was and they were right, by the way. There was a criticism against the traditional shuls where things were too chaotic. Things were too, like, they were embarrassed. The term you keep on hearing in a lot of the early literature is that people were embarrassed when they would bring their Christian friends to shul, which was a thing. And there are many, you know, great Christian leaders who write about their times when they were in shul. That's what they would do. Okay, that's fine. You could have Christians in shul. That's okay. They were embarrassed because there were people who were walking around and everyone's davening at their own pace and people are schmoozing and people are drinking in the back. Whatever it was, it didn't have that. And you walk into a church and it was regal. There was a sense of awe. There was a sense of reverence. And it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. And you find, you know, highly traditional writers, Maariv Tzachias and Arachais and others talking about, yeah, this is embarrassing, but this shouldn't be this way. This, right? We've been talking about the main theme of Shul, which we've been talking about for the past couple of weeks, is awe and reverence, right? Many shuls, that wasn't the case. You didn't have a sense of awe and reverence. And their neighbors had a sense of awe and reverence in their churches. And therefore, the earliest stages of the Reform movement were really, much of it was copying what was being done in the Reform, in the churches, right? As a way of saying, we want to be like that. We want to have that sense of awe and reverence, right? One of the big fights in the early years was the robes, the clerical robes that were worn by the priests. You know, the rabbis wanted to wear them. And that was a big fight. You know, ultimately, it was adopted by many of the Orthodox rabbi, you know, what they call the neo-Orthodox. So Rabbi Rav Hirsch started wearing those robes, and his Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, started wearing those robes. But it was a big fight because, are we copying them? Is that appropriate? But the bottom line is that for the first 100 years, there was no, the churches had separate seating, and therefore the Reform synagogues, temples, whatever, they also had separate seating. They're the most famous, most interesting case, even the beginning of the 20th century, the Hamburg Temple, major, major, major Reform temple, they were offered a 1 million mark donation, which is a good amount of money, by an individual who's actually an American banker, who I think he was moving there or whatever. I forgot exactly the background, but basically he had a couple of stipulations. And one of them was, I want to have a million marks, which is going to go a long way back in the day. He said, well, I want to have mixed pews. And the answer was no. They rejected the donation. Sure, it wasn't an easy decision. They rejected the donation, saying, this is out of line. Imagine Reformed Temple right now saying we're going to reject in a million, right? But they said, no, this was out of line. This is not what we do, right? When does mixed pews start becoming a thing? We'll get to Mechitza soon. But when does this idea of mixed seating start taking place? So again, and you could follow a very easy line between what's being done by the churches, what's being done by Christians, and its influence on shuls. So in the 18th century already, you start finding American churches start to have mixed pews, okay, where you have mixed seating. And the reason for that, the rationale for that is because end of the 18th century, you start to have, you know, people are going to workforce, you have the Industrial Revolution, and there is a change, and there is already literature of how it's changing family life. You know, every time there's a change in society, there's always, it's a fair question, because many of the changes do impact family life, but there is a major discussion, a major concern about, you know, the husbands are out very late, and some of the women are starting to go to work, and how is this going to impact the family dynamic? People are not as together as they once were. Right? And therefore, churches want to be the place where people are able to maintain the sense of family. And so the notion, the term, the phrase, the family that prays together stays together, I'm sure you've heard that, that's where it comes from. It comes to the end of the 18th century, okay? And it's only really in the mid-19th century, where you start to find that change taking place in Reformed temples. The first person who does so is a man by the name of Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise. He was a rather radical Reform rabbi. He was kicked out of his own synagogue for his Reform ideas, meaning even though it was a synagogue which was Reformed, but his ideas were too radical for his age. They decided he couldn't be there. I don't remember all the details, but apparently there was a fight that broke out between him and the shul president who had kicked him out on Rosh Hashanah. He showed up even though he was kicked out, and apparently he hit off the hat, the top hat, big deal, of the president of the shul, and there was a big fight, whatever it was. Ultimately, he was kicked out of his synagogue, and he starts his own place. And where does he find a space? He ends up buying or renting initially a space from a church in Albany, New York, okay? And it's a church which has mixed seating. And he likes it. He's like, hey, this is cool. We could do this, right? And so he's the first one to do so, but it's not even you have to draw a line. He literally buys a church. Again, I think he rents a church, and it's a church where there is no separate seating, all the seating's together. And he says, fine, this is what we're going to do. And it becomes, and eventually he builds a famous shul, the Plum Street Synagogue, and this becomes the norm eventually within America. And again, it picks up in America first because in American churches, you have mixed seating as opposed to in Europe where it didn't actually take off until much later, okay? That's some of the background. And we'll see where some of their justification comes in, because like, where does that come from? You know, in the early, you have to appreciate that in the early years of the Reform movement, they had responsa, they had tshuvos, just like we do. You know, nowadays, and for an adjustment to be made, I'm not an expert in the Reform movement, but you don't have to, you know, it's a very different system. You know, there's voting, you know, what do we believe, what do we want to believe, et cetera, et cetera. Back in the day, any adjustments that were made in the reform movements were built upon responsa, halachic responsa, similar to responsa that we have right now. The early leaders, many of them, not all of them, were highly intelligent, highly educated, meaning Talmudically educated, traditionally educated, and they were using their knowledge. They had some ideas, which we wouldn't agree with, but essentially, so you'll find, just like you'll have, Moshe Feinstein has his tshuva explaining why we do XYZ, they had their tshuva explaining why we do XYZ. So we'll see one of the big issues, one of the reasons for having a mechitza, which we'll get into the text in just a moment, is a term called kalus rosh, which means levity. That there was a concern of there being levity in a davening setting. That's the issue. Levity, whatever exactly levity means, which we'll unpack. And so one of the reform thinkers, the early reform thinkers, who has to justify the Gemara. In other words, nowadays, I imagine you'd hear an argument saying, well, you know, that's archaic, that was for the past, and we don't have to, but there they deal with the text and they have to reckon with the text. And so the response to the text and to the Gemara, which speaks about the concern for levity, the response was, and I'm quoting over here, this is not me speaking, by Rabbi David Einhorn, Temple Har Sinai, big, very, very prominent Reform rabbi, big thinker, and one of the leaders of, again, some of the more radical changes. He argued that levity was only an issue in the Near East. Okay, one of the big arguments you find in the early years of the Reform movements, and this is going to sound highly racial, it is, they basically said that Jews at the time were Oriental, and they were influenced by, they lived in the Near East, and they were influenced by, they had a whole different way of life, which was not as refined as us Europeans or Americans, and this Oriental way of thinking, and basically there was this frivolity and levity that existed, but we are refined human beings, and therefore those issues do not exist. That was their argument. That was the argument that they made, and therefore they said, we don't have to worry about mechitza, we don't have to worry about separate seating, because it was for a people who were more primitive, and we are no longer primitive like they were, okay? That argument probably wouldn't fly right now, probably be seen as, you know, racist. But anyway, bottom line is that as time goes on, mixed seating becomes more and more common. The conservative movement, the leadership of the conservative movement was adamantly opposed to mixed seating. Through the 50s of the 20th century, the leadership was a pretty traditional, I guess we'd say, and they were opposed, but virtually all conservative synagogues, despite the leadership, the people in JTS, despite their thinking, the most conservative synagogues adopted throughout the 20th century mixed seating. Now, it wasn't just the conservative shuls. They say there is no actual studies, but there are quotes from the mid that era as well, where they say that 50% of Reitz graduates, meaning YU Musmachim, that 50% of Reitz graduates had mixed pews in the 50s, okay? Which is a pretty wild thought when you think about it. That 50% of YU graduates had mixed seating. Yes?
How many YU graduates were acting as rabbis for conservative shuls, though? Like a lot of conservative shuls hired Orthodox.
Well, yeah, you have to keep in mind, JTS and OU were so similar. Reitz were so similar at that stage. There was constant back and forth between them. I mean, you speak to people who lived during that, you know, who were in either of those programs at the time. They were jumping. People were shifting back and forth. People were diving. The similarities were immense. Really, one of the most important figures that really changes this is Rav Soloveitchik comes along, and this becomes one of his big fights. He feels that this is going to be the end of Orthodoxy as we know it if we are adopting too many of these things, and he puts his foot down and he has some strong language and strong arguments against mixed seating. There's a famous story that is told by one of his students, by Rav Schechter, who says that Rav Soloveitchik was once asked by one of his students, he was in a city where there was... It was Rosh Hashanah. He was in a city where there was Rosh Hashanah, and he was the only shul that was in this city had mixed seating. And his students wanted to know, well, I have to go to Kiyah Shofar. It's a mitzvah dough, right? You know, I have to go hear the shofar. Should I go to the shul to hear the shofar? And Soloveitchik said, it's better that you missed Kiyah Shofar and not go to that shul as opposed to going to that shul with mixed seating. That was Rav Soloveitchik's view, and this is just emblematic. This was just like a symbol of his very, very strong view against mixed seating, and he really put his foot down, and it really, all that's around when you see the shift, the tide shifting, the 60, 50, late 50s, 60s, with Rav Soloveitchik's influence, and more and more, YU graduates are starting to no longer accept positions in a shul which has mixed seating, or even a shul that doesn't have a mechitza, unless you find scenarios where he did allow some of his students to assume those positions, but with a very clear mandate that within X amount of years, you will have a mechitza, and the shift and the tide starts to shift, where nowadays you would say that you know, if you'd walk into shul, there's no mechitza, you'd say, it's by definition, it's not an Orthodox synagogue, right? Not an Orthodox shul. That was not the given back then, but that's really when it starts to change, and Rav Soloveitchik probably could get a significant amount of the credit. There were actually some legal cases that were brought in where shuls who were Orthodox wanted to drop their mechitza. Because around that time, again, the reason this is happening is because, you know, in the 50s, everyone said, what was everyone saying? Orthodoxy's dead. Mm-hmm. Right? If you were to ask anyone, they would tell you that Orthodox, you could look, I mean, there's Marshall Sklar was the big, he was a sociologist, thank you, yes. He was the big sociologist studying American Judaism, and he was, you know, a big proponent of this notion that, you know, based on the trajectories, Orthodoxy was dead in America, and it was just a matter of time. And so many shuls were saying, well, we have to get with the times, we're losing our members, so let's drop the pews. And so there's two legal debates. I don't even know how that happens. I don't know enough about these are religious discussions, but the question is, if you call yourself an Orthodox shul, can you get rid of your mechitza? Is that legal? And this was fought in the courts, two famous cases. Yes?
I don't know if you know this, Dr. Sklar's son lives here and is from, and his grandson gives...
Rabbi Yonah Sklar is his grandson. Yes, 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 yeah.
Very
so,
ironic.
Ironic indeed, and his grandson is a Talmudic scholar par excellence. I mean, clearly there was some good genes in that family. But yes, yes, yeah, pretty amazing, pretty amazing. Okay, now that we have some history, historic backgrounds, we're going to jump through the sources. Don't get too spoiled with these English translations, because next week we're going back to the Hebrew, I'm sorry. But I just happened to translate some of these back in the day. So let's go through the original sources that talk about the mechitza, and they go like this. Okay, so sorry, this is a review from those who missed it. Okay, so the Mishnah in Tractate Midos, okay, so the Mishnah is a Midos, says like this. It says, the women's courtyard, the Ezras Nashim. When we hear the word Ezras Nashim, we associate that with the women's section, right? In the Beis HaMikdash, in the Temple Mount, okay, the Ezras Nashim was actually the term, ironically, interestingly, was the term for the entire courtyard where both men and women were able to be. Okay, it ends up being called the Ezras Nashim, but it's not really just for women. The section we know on the Temple Mount, there are sections where non-Kohanim are able to stand, that whole section is actually the Ezras Nashim, okay? So if you're learning Mishnah, it gets confusing, or the Gemara, because Ezras Nashim does not mean just the women's section, it means that entire area where men and women who are non-Kohanim were able to stand. So that wall was originally smooth. There were no protrusions from it. But later a balcony was built around it so that the women could watch from above with the men from below so they would not be mixed. Okay, so this Mishnah over here is telling us that originally there was no women's section. There was no separate place. Eventually, they built a balcony for the women. Now, one important, interesting, you know, historic question, which I don't have an answer for, is how many women went to the Beis HaMikdash back in the day. You know, just like nowadays, we could ask the question. You know, now our soul, you know, thank God, we are our issue is that, you know, sometimes we have more women coming than men. So we have to like reconfigure our seating sometimes, you know, figuring out like Rosh Hashanah Kippur which is beautiful. It's great. But we know that historically, many women are even nowadays, certain places, women don't go to shul in certain communities. So we don't know, you know, we certainly know that women would attend the Beis HaMikdash. The most famous tefillah was penned at the Mishkan, right? Chana, Shmuel's mother, the source of saying davening quietly comes from a tefillah that was said by a woman in the Mishkan, or the precursor for the Mishkan, the precursor for the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan. But did women regularly attend when the Beis HaMikdash gets filled with people, when they would really have what I'd call services, was that filled with women? There's a good chance not, right? Because what are the times that the Beis HaMikdash gets filled up? Shlosh Regalim, right? The three festivals. Who is mandated to go for the Shlosh Regalim? Men, right? Oh, the mitzvah of Ol Regel, Alila Regel, is specifically for men, right? The Pesukim talk about the fact that you leave your women, and, you know, it's a little funny. We wouldn't, like, you know, nowadays if someone were to ask me, like, you know, I want to go to Uman for Rosh Hashanah and leave my wife behind, I'll tell you, yeah, and you might leave your wife behind, you know, but it's not recommended practice, not a recommended practice. So sorry? It's not your shlime, but either way, to leave your spouse for a holiday to me seems like completely against the spirit of the holiday. But in truth, that's what was done. Yes?
I thought the Vienna was to bring your family with you.
So people did, but it certainly wasn't obligatory, and we don't know to what extent people were bringing their family with them because...
It was infants, like it's very...
Yeah, so, right, so the Gemara talks about, you know, what age do you bring the children along with you, but those are also the male children. So we don't know. We know the chiyuv, we know the obligation is for men. I'm just pointing out, we don't know how full the courtyard was with both men and women. At a later point in history, there is a discussion. This is the Gemara in Sukkah, which we're about to read. We know that there is all, you know, there becomes a developed ceremony and celebration called the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Okay, which, you know, which basically was this incredible, you know, nowadays, you know, you go different places, different, you have different models of a Simchas Beis HaShoeva, but in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, and this is the second Beis HaMikdash, you have a description of, you know, basically the leaders of the time would be at the center, and they would kind of entertain the crowd, right? This, you know, they were the leaders, but they would juggle like, you know, torches, and they would do different things, and they would entertain the crowd. It wasn't like everyone was dancing, like you go to Simchas Beis HaShoeva now. There was basically entertainment led by the leadership of the Jewish people. That's what the Simchas Beis HaShoeva looked like. It seems like, or I'm positing, that at that point, you know, now it's a bit more of attraction. It's not just, you know, animal sacrifice, but now it's getting exciting. So it seems like at that, I would posit that it's only at a later point that that there is this question that women start coming to the Beis HaMikdash en masse. And perhaps, and we'll see why I'm saying this, perhaps, and this is just a theory, perhaps at an earlier point, certainly when the earlier years of the Beis HaMikdash, or the first Beis HaMikdash, I'm not so confident that women were there en masse. Okay, and when you'll appreciate, I think, in a moment why I'm suggesting that. So let's now get into the Gemara that talks about the women's section and specifically the building of what we'll call the women's balcony in the Beis HaMikdash courtyard. So our rabbis have taught originally. Now we're at this last source on the page. Our rabbis originally, the women used to sit within the court of the women while the men were outside. Okay, but this would cause levity. So what they're telling us is that when there was the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, you had the rabbis in the middle, so you had, like, I don't know, you had Hillel in the middle, and then you had the women surrounding him, okay, and he would do his thing, and the men on the outer perimeter. Interesting, right? Okay, but it would cause levity. It doesn't define what levity is, but it would cause some problems. It was instituted that the women should sit outside, and the men inside, so they said, let's switch it up. Let's have the women on the outside, the men on the inside, but they would still come to levity. Didn't work. Whatever this levity is, still a problem. So it was instituted that the women should sit above and the men below. So then they said, okay, what we're going to do is we'll put the women above and the men below, and that would solve the problems. How do you put women above? You build a balcony. And so they build the very first balcony in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Gemara has a technical question, which we'll see is important, of course. But how could they do so? Is it not written, all this do I give you in writing as the Lord has made me wise by his hand upon me? So this is a pasuk which describes the fact that the structure of the entire Temple Mount was all divinely ordained. You can't go ahead, you know, they can't come along like 300 years into building the Beis HaMikdash, you know, like the styles have changed. I don't really like this whole Kruvim thing or the you know, too many squares. We need more circles. We're like into, you know, things, the styles have changed. We're gonna renovate the Beis HaMikdash and do it with, you know, modern sensibilities and modern style. Uh-uh, you can't do so. It's divinely ordained. So the Gemara is asking, wait a second, the courtyard is part of the Temple Mount. How do they just go ahead and build a courtyard, a balcony? You can't do that. You can't mess around, right? So that's what the Gemara is asking. Yes. This is during the second Beis HaMikdash. So things are different to begin with, which is another story. The Gemara does have an extensive discussion about that question. Wait a second, you know, not over here, but the whole second Beis HaMikdash was, the scale was incomparable to the first one. Extensive discussion. Ultimately, they argue that the most classic traditional argument is that it just was scaled differently, but there was no substantive changes. Maybe the designs changed, but ultimately it was scaled differently, but the basic structure was intact. We could debate that point, but the Gemara has to deal with that question as well as it does elsewhere. Yeah. So the Gemara ultimately has the following answer. They found a verse. Rav said, they found a verse and expounded it, and the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, and their wives apart. Okay, so the pasuk in Zechariah, which speaks about this funeral that's going to take place at the end of days, according to the tradition. It's a funeral for, anyone know? Mashiach ben Yosef. Okay, so this messianic figure, this precursor to the Mashiach as we know it, Mashiach ben David, there is, according to some traditions, two messianic figures. One is from the family of Yosef, and he's going to die in this cataclysmic end of days war between Gog and Magog and the Jewish people. Mashiach ben Yosef dies there. We're not getting into that all right now, but bottom line is there's this mass funeral, and it says at the mass funeral that the men mourned separate from the women. Okay, fine. So they said, is there not a, what we'll call a kal v'chomer, basically a inference that we can make, if in the future, when they will be engaged in mourning, and the evil inclination will have no power over them, the Torah nevertheless says men separately and women separately, how much more so now when they are engaged in rejoicing, and the evil inclination has sway over them. So the Gemara basically says like this, how did they justify the building of a mechitza, a building of a balcony? At the end of the day, you can't make changes. So what they're arguing for is, no, there's some biblical support for making a women's section. And once you have the biblical support, then you're allowed to. So what's the argument? The argument is, at the end of days, they're middle of a funeral, which, you know, perhaps the level of the libido is perhaps down. And at the end of days, the evil inclination is going to be subdued. And nonetheless, they have to separate the men from the women. Okay, so therefore, in the times of Sukkot, where it's all, you know, it's fun and games, everyone's celebrating, and it's the modern era where our evil inclination is still intact and doing well, therefore, certainly, there is this need to separate, and once there's a biblical need to separate, we could then say, well, once there's a biblical need, and we recognize that biblical need, therefore, that would justify making a change in the Beis HaMikdash. Yes?
There's no halacha that there has to be mechitza at a funeral, correct?
There is, well, it's a good question. It's a good question. The short answer is no, certainly not mechitza. Even separate seating, you know, this Gemara seems to indicate yes. We're not really going to get into it. There is some question about the bottom line is that Rav Moshe Feinstein has three criteria for what is need. When do you need a mechitza? He basically says it has to be something which is obligatory. So let's say something like davening, which you must do, which a funeral you don't have to attend. Okay. That would exclude that. It has to be something open to the public. So anything private, he says no. And it has to be something which is set, like a set place. So for example, what would be an interesting exception to this? A minyan at a shiva house, right? A minyan at a shiva house, davening for at least the men is obligatory, right? It's open to the public. Shiva house is open to the public, but it's not a set place. Right? So according to that reasoning, you would not need to have full-fledged, you know, he says you don't need a mechitza. He says you should still sit separately, but you wouldn't need a mechitza in a shiva house for this reason. So at a funeral.
So if there's a funeral in a shul.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So you would, so technically you would not need to have a mechitza, presumably because it's not obligatory. Yeah.
I have bad experience.
Okay. I'm sure many people on the other side of this shtender had bad experiences that I can't speak to. But yeah. 100%. But yeah, strictly speaking, there would be no obligation of mechitza there. Yes. What about wedding? About chuppah? Yeah, so this is a little more complicated because the brachos over there might be some more of a chiyuv. You mean the ceremony or you mean the ceremony? The ceremony, yeah. A little bit more complicated, a little bit more of a debate. Again, it doesn't fulfill all its criteria because typically weddings are not open to the public. So it would seem that it's not obligatory. It would seem as some disagree. You know, I think the most creative approach I've seen or heard about was you need to have a minyan for the Sheva Brachos. So some, what they would do is they'll have like a group of men almost separate, you know, and then everyone else could sit together if they want, as long as you have your minyan that is there for the Sheva Brachos, like in the front. But yeah, yes.
But it's not a set place. In other words, and there's this issue of having the chuppah in a shul.
So right.
It's not in the shul. In a
different room. So again, yeah, that would lessen the need to have separate seating. Yeah. So a bit more of a debate about weddings, but
Yeah.
So separate seating and mechitza kind of go hand in hand, and we'll see a little bit more about that. So based on this Gemara that we just read, let's just one important thing: is the obligation for mechitza biblical or rabbinic? What would you say? So none of the sources are biblical. Good, you're right. So on the one hand, it's found in the Gemara. There's no pasuk in the Torah that says you should have a mechitza. Yes?
Well, they quote a pasuk, but it depends whether you use that pasuk as a source or as a hint.
Here's a hint, right, right. And even the verse that we're quoting is not from the five books of Moshe, which would normally disqualify it. But Rav Moshe Feinstein has an argument. He says, listen, he says that if at the end of the day, it's true. Typically, a verse from the Nevi'im is not a source of Jewish law. But he says, if you're following the back and forth in the Gemara, they're looking for a biblical source. They can't do it with just a hint. A hint would not be enough because there is a prohibition against building in the Beis HaMikdash, which they understand as a actual halacha. And therefore, they're going to need something to counter that, which has to be biblical. So sometimes you find the following argument in the Gemara, even when it's a non-biblical source, meaning by biblical, I mean the five books of Moshe, okay? Nonetheless, when you find the source in the later books, it doesn't mean that that is the source for it, but it's a reflection of a pre-existing idea. Okay, so a number of times this theory comes up. You find places where later prophets will talk about something and will say they're not the ones introducing the idea. They're the ones discussing an idea, indicative of the fact that there is something that precedes it, which already pre-exists. So there might be what we'll call an oral tradition, which is on par with something which is d'oraisa. And therefore, Moshe Feinstein is of the opinion, based on his read of the Gemara, that the obligation to have separate seating / a mechitza is actually biblical in nature. Not everyone agrees. Rav Henkin disagrees. He says, no, that's not the appropriate read. We're not going to get into the entire analysis, but it's just interesting to note, is the obligation, everyone agrees there's an obligation. The question is it biblical or rabbinic? That is a debate between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Yehuda Henkin. Yes. It does. Yeah. This is not unprecedented. There are other places where you have discussions of shtaros, for example, where. Yeah, I think that is seen as rabbinic because it's the same. I think it's the same source to talk about like mukts and other places. I believe. I'm not 100% sure. But the notion exists. It's a murky area because once you start going, you know. But basically, the notion is that it's not being taught there, but it's a reflection of a pre-existing idea. Okay, that said. Okay, rabbinic, biblical. Bottom line is there's an obligation. The question is why? What is the, you know, this idea of levity that is being discussed in the Gemara? What's it all about? Okay, and the question of what's it all about will have significant ramifications in halacha. Okay, we'll see there are three different approaches to this question, and they will have very, very significant ramifications to the nature of the mechitza that you have, the height of the mechitza that you have. Okay, so let's go through these three different sources. The first is from a public declaration. Again, as I noted, there's really not so much literature on mechitza for thousands of years. Because it wasn't a question, it didn't come up as a question. It was in the Beis HaMikdash, it was a question, but it seems like women didn't go to shul or wasn't really debated. And, you know, maybe some shuls had their own practices, but it never became like a hot button issue that you find extensive literature. The literature is really only found in the past 100 and really 200 years. So the first is there was this public declaration when the reform movement's taking off. One of the ways, you know, one, there's a big, you know, two different models of how to counter the reform movement. One was what we'll call the classical traditional model, which probably wasn't so effective with the reform movements. Maybe it was more effective internally, which was what we'll call like the Pashkevalim. You know, if you ever go to Israel, you'll see in Yerushalayim and Mea Shearim, you see these like signs, you know, basically they'll say like, this is terrible, this is usur, this is forbidden. And it's not going to influence the person who's doing it, but it kind of is a way of almost like scare, like building like the circling the wagon, you know, basically a way of maintaining within. And so when the reform movement starts taking off, one of the modalities of response is these public declarations, which are like bashing what's being done. Others have a, you know, a different approach, which is much more dialectical, you know, but this is one approach. And there's this public declaration about mechitzas, which is signed by 70 rabbis in the 19th century. One of the people signing on, most famous to many of us, is the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, slim book, which summarizes all of Jewish law, Rav Shlomo Ganzfried. And it says over there, it is forbidden to make the partition separating the men's and women's section in a way that men can look at women. Okay? In other words, part of this public declaration says any mechitza that does not prevent full view, in other words, any mechitza where you could still see one another, that is not a good mechitza. Their argument is that the function of mechitza is to ensure that men cannot see the women. Okay? They would not come and daven here. Okay, but the bottom line is, so according to this view, according to this perspective, the goal of the mechitza is to prevent, and if you go back to the Gemara, the idea of levity, according to them, is what? Is the, any gazing, any seeing of one another, That's the issue that mechitza is coming to address, and therefore a mechitza would have to be something where it has to cover a person. You cannot see each other whatsoever. That would be the necessity. How high is such a mechitza? As high as the tallest woman in the shul, let's say, right? Basically, the bottom line is has to be, you know, 6 feet or whatever it's going to be, maybe taller, in order to ensure that men and women do not see each other at all. Okay? That's opinion number one, and that's an opinion that many shuls adopt. Ramosha Feinstein has a very different argument. He says, it seems to me, and we're at the middle of the second page, it seems to me that that it is enough to have a mechitza higher than the shoulders. Okay? As long as it's higher than the shoulders, we're okay. If we have seen the mechitza is not to prevent looking. Okay? How does he prove that? He proves that because the fact that think about the original situation in the Beis HaMikdash, right? They have the women in the inside, the men on the outside, and the men are looking kind of through the women to see the rabbis in the middle of that whole thing. So they obviously see each other. By definition, they're looking in their direction. So obviously, the issue is not a matter of looking at one another. Now again, to be clear, there are halachos about praying, for men to pray and women to pray in a scenario where people are uncovered. And uncovered, you know, there are laws about what has to be covered, what not has to be covered. So such laws exist. Such laws exist. But we're talking about, but even then, you know, in order to be prohibited from praying, it would have to be like, you'd have to be gazing in that area, even if they're in your, you know, even if they're in your sight line, it might not be problematic. But the bottom line is, Ramosha Feinstein saying, clearly originally, women were in men's view, and when they flipped it, men were in women's view, and that was not an issue. The issue was that there was still frivolity, whatever that existed, but clearly they were looking at each other, right? So clearly gazing, seeing is not the issue. Rather, it's this notion of frivolity, okay? So, but it is somewhat necessary to say this law is biblical, as we pointed out, and without a need for gathering, fine, let's just pause over here. So basically saying that the issue is not seeing, the issue is something more akin to some level of mixing. That's how Ramosha Feinstein seems to be understanding it. That the issue is, and he understands frivolity, that there is going to be some engagement between men and women. And therefore, he assumes, and he doesn't actually quote a source for this, but he's basically, this is his read of the Gemara. If the issue is a matter of interaction, a matter of that we're too connected over here, and we'll see why that's such an issue when it comes to a shul, we'll get back to that. But if that's the issue, you could see each other in the biblical times, in the temple times, they saw each other. But as long as there's no mixing. Now, how do you make sure there's no mixing? So he basically suggests that it has to be shoulder height. Okay? How much is shoulder height? Depends how tall you are. So shoulder height. So, you know, there are different opinions of Ramosha, where Ramosha's measurements was, anywhere between like 53 inches to 60 inches. There are different, he didn't actually write it in this text, but he understands the idea is some separation. So it has to be enough that it's not like, you know, if it's a very low separation, you're basically, it's like a little, you know, table between you. You have coffee tables, you have other, you know, things, and you're basically could talk to one another over this little thing. That's not enough. It has to be enough where there is some level of, you know, discomfort, some level of awkwardness, that it's no longer one continuous place. And his suggestion is that shoulder height, again, there's a bit of a difference of opinion, probably 56 inches, the most agreed upon measurements for a Moshe, but somewhere between 53 and 60 inches is the measurement needed in order to ensure that level of separation. Now, according to Moshe Feinstein, let me ask you a question. If the mechitza is a glass mechitza, would that work? It would. It would, because according to him, it's not about seeing at all. According to him, the whole issue is separation. So if I can't really casually converse with someone on the other side of that separation, then we're good to go, right? I might be able to make motions, I might be able to wave, but I'm not, you know, interacting in any way. And therefore, again, according to him, it's more about having, ensuring that there's some level of separation. So whereas according to the first opinion, a glass mechitza, no way. The whole point is seeing. And therefore, it would have to be something which you cannot see through. According to Moshe, you could see through as long as that separation ensures that there is a lack of, you know, interaction, then you'd be totally fine. Okay? So big nafkamina, big difference between these two opinions, whether or not, and therefore you'll see some shuls have, you know, large glass mechitzas, and that's coming from this view of Ramosha Feinstein. Okay? There's one more opinion, and it's interesting, it's worth reading inside, because it's actually not found very often in writing, but that is a view of Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, but it's not found in any of Rav Soloveitchik's writings. It's quoted by Rav Henkin. Okay, Rav Henkin, one of the, you know, big, very important scholar, it's like this. He says, I will also reveal that which I say and heard from the guests great to my homeland, from a trustworthy group that Rav Soloveitchik occasionally allowed prayer with a 10 hand-width mechitza in a difficult situation. Okay, very interesting. So Rav Henkin, who is a big makel, he's probably the most lenient, especially when it comes to women's issues. He was very sensitive to all women's issues, and you know, it's through his family that we have, you know, Rabbanit Henkin comes from that family, and she's the head of the Yotzot program. Anyway, so he is of the opinion that he quotes, the Rav Soloveitchik in times of need would tell people that a 32-inch mechitza would be enough. Now, two things worth noting. First of all, where does this 32 inches come from? It's actually the most logical, it would seem, form of a mechitza, because whenever you find the word mechitza in the Talmud, it has a very defined measurement. The word mechitza means a wall, a partition. Now, it's worth noting in the Talmud, it doesn't describe the separation, the balcony, as a mechitza. But what we use, when we describe this thing over here, we call it a mechitza. Mechitza is a halachic wall. Okay? The most relevant example of this is when it comes to building a sukkah. In a sukkah, you need to have a certain amount of walls, and those walls need to have a certain height. Okay? So if you ever notice those straps in sukkahs, right? Those sukkah straps, right? What are those? What they're doing is they are building a halachic wall. Why? Because, you know, when you have flappy walls, there's some discussion about whether or not that's a good wall or not. Fine. We're not getting into that. You probably don't need those straps. But the point is that the bottom line is that in order to create a halachic wall, you need it to be 32 inches, because 32 inches, 10 tefachim, is enough to be considered a halachic wall. So Rav Soloveitchik was of the opinion that, similar to Rav Moshe saying that you could see each other, the point is to have separation. Now Rav Moshe said, well, separation, well, make it awkward. So what's awkward? The shoulder height is awkward. Rav Soloveitchik is saying, no, whenever we have separation, you know, you separate into a separate domain, right? And a separate domain is 10 tefachim, 32 inches, which is quite small, right? And therefore, I think in Bet Tefillah, I believe it's a 32-inch mechitza, I believe, yes?
But he specifically says in the difficult situations, that would be like...
Point number two, right? Don't, right? In a difficult situation is not whatever you want, right? Right. So this is the halachic, you'll find, this is the halachic system or halachic dynamic. And you'll find constantly in halacha where poskim will say, you know, they'll even say, you'll have tshuvas where poskim will say about a certain question, this is what I think, but I don't want to rule on this, you know, in practicality. And then like a generation later, it's just accepted as the normative halacha, okay? The halachic system is a little complicated. One thing I think my takeaway from Shavuos after all these discussions was, I think next Shavuos we're going to dedicate the whole Shavuos, maybe, Bli Neder, to how the halachic system works. It's fun. It's a little boring to some, but it's fun for me. I don't know. And basically, it's complicated, right? How does halacha work? But you're right. He's saying it's in a difficult situation. And many say, well, this is Rav Soloveitchik's view. It's okay. So if it's okay, it's okay. How do you define a difficult situation? My congregation wants it. Well, is that a difficult situation? So bottom line is, it evolves where there's this oral tradition and it becomes like almost... you know, the norm at a certain point afterwards. That it's not the only situation where you find such a thing. Now, it's interesting. Anyone know how tall this mechitza is? I measured it once. I think it's like 43 inches, okay? Yeah. I don't know what that's... I wish I knew. I wish, you know, there's so much history of this world, I just don't know. But it's... I don't know. It's their own measurements. I don't know. It's not, you know, it's not Rav Moshe. It's not Rav Soloveitchik. It's somewhere in between. Okay, yeah.
But only on this side.
Only on this side. What do you mean? Oh, only the men's side. Right. Now, again, according to Rav Soloveitchik, that makes a ton of sense, right? Meaning, according to Rav Moshe, the issue is being able to engage with one another. So if it's elevated on one side, then, you know, that doesn't necessarily help because the women can lean over. Usually it's the men leaning over, though. I know. I remind them whenever I can. So, for according to Rav Soloveitchik, it's not, you know, the whole issue is you need a halachic mechitza. So even if it's on one side, that's totally fine. Right? So it could be it's 32 inches post the thing, post elevation. I'm not sure. Maybe that's it. I never measured it that way. Okay, it's been a while. But okay, those are the three different opinions, right? 32 inches, 56, 60 inches, or you cannot see one another, with major debates about size based on what is the conceptual reason behind mechitza. In addition, this question of is it see-through, not see-through, will also play a role. Okay. Yes, Lisa, you're going to ask something here.
I was just going to ask, can we put something on top of it?
Yeah, I always wanted to put like spikes or barbed wire for the men. If they want to lean over, they could, you know.
It could be something
nicer. Oh, okay, fine. something nice. Okay, fair enough. Well, longer discussion, not for this class, but yes.
If there are halakhos regarding a pizza, why is it such a hot topic?
Well, we'll just use this sociologically, but think about it. Meaning, you know, There are people who come to the shul for this explicit reason that women that come to the shul saying, I could feel like I could hear the chazan, I could hear the rabbi, the rabbi, and I could see things. I could feel like I'm part of the davening, right? So there's part of that, and that's purely right, which plays a role, right? There's also, what does it represent? You know, for some people, it's not practical anymore. It's, what does it represent? You know, mechitz, because it's almost like a self-feeding loop. You know, because it's become such a big topic, so then mechitz, if you change the mechitz, what does it say about me? I don't want to say the statement. So there's layers to this, right? And the more it becomes an issue, the more it becomes an issue. So it's loaded. It becomes an explosive, divisive, ironically divisive topic. The mechitz is the most divisive thing in shul, which is what it's supposed to do, right? So it becomes this very explosive topic. But you see in these sources, right, very clearly, there is no notion of, you know, that the notion of a women's section where women cannot hear things. No, that there's no such thing, right? On the contrary, right? The original setting had the women on the inside and the men on the outside, right? Imagine we do that. Imagine we build a mechitza around the beam over here, put the women over here, and put the men on the outside, right? Maybe some of you will love it. I'm sure people lose their head. Okay, their heads will literally explode. Okay, but technically, right, that would follow some biblical model. I'm not promoting that. But the point is, right? So but a model which I certainly would love, you know, is a mechitza down the middle where women are just as close, if not closer, to the chazan, to the rabbi, you know, and basically are part of as much as they can be part of it. Yes. We traditionally, women are not going to lead the davening. You know, that's fine. But there's nothing about mechitza that says they should be anywhere separate and distinct and far away or hearing less, etc., from any part of the davening. No such thing, right? So unfortunately, structurally, sometimes when mechitza is built, you know, women's views are not necessarily taken into account or whatever it might be. But nothing that we're seeing, even the most strict opinion, you know, would say, okay, it should be tall enough that you cannot see each other. Fine. So throw a mechitza down the middle where you cannot see each other. Great. But the women will be right here where they could see everything and be closer to the action, and you're fine. You're good to go. Right? That would be, yes. Go ahead.
So I'm just mentioning this just because I'm wondering where it comes from. So back when Shomrei built the mechitza the way it is now, and they had been talking, there was a debate in the shul about whether it should be side by side.
Right.
And I think the answer was that Rabbi Bach, who was the original Rabbi Shul, had said no.
Right.
Obviously, was basing that on something.
Correct. So good. Yes, fair. So let's address that. So the issue became, and this is again where you have these like self-feeding loops, where this became like almost like a sign of modernity to have it down the middle. Strictly speaking, again, we're going through the stories over here. There's nothing about that. But if you look, you know, the shuls where, you know, became, again, this goes back to Rabbi Sarna's quotes. You know, you walk into a shul, you could tell if you were to have a mechitza down the middle as opposed to on the side, you would know something about the shul, right? I would say, you know, you would know that the women have a place in the shul. Others would argue and know that it's, you know, that it's too modern, right? I mean, if the seating of a shul, you know, if you were to go to HIR in Riverdale, that's Rabbi Avi Weiss's shul, the mechitza is down the middle, right? And many of the more modern Orthodox shuls in the tri-state area, the mechitza is more or less down the middle for that reason. So therefore, it becomes like, okay, well, if they're trying to, and look, you have to, you know, it's his prerogative to decide, you know, what is appropriate for the shul, for the growth of the shul, the development of the shul. If you do something which is going to be seen as something which people feel uncomfortable, maybe it's not a good idea, right? That's you know, what are they, you know, like beyond halacha type of assessment which has to be made, and, you know, by all means. But strictly speaking, there's no issue with that. Okay, fine. Two other considerations that we want to keep in mind when we think about mechitza. One is, you know, I'll skip the next. Rabbi Lam took up the mantle of his teacher, of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and also railed often against the mechitza. He argued that going to a shul, and this could explain Rabbi Soloveitchik's view, which wasn't adopted by all, who, at least according to this one story and maybe in other places, he was so adamantly opposed to people davening a place without mechitza. He felt that if you went by looking at the history, right, which we started with, it's clear that the whole notion of mixed pews and the whole sensitivity originally emanated from trying to emulate the churches and trying to emulate what was being done around us in society. We know there's a biblical prohibition against imitating what's being done by non-Jews. You should not follow their statutes. And so there would be a biblical prohibition, you'd be in violation of biblical prohibition by even entering such a place. And therefore, that could explain why Rav Soloveitchik partially could have been sociological and trying to stem the tide, but partially this was based on this view that going into such a shul would be in violation of such a prohibition. So ironically, Rav Soloveitchik or Elam were in some ways more strict about going to a shul with mixed pews, whereas I know there are, Feinstein was much more lenient in trying situations where someone had a family member, they had a simcha, you know, their reformed cousin, whatever, a brother, whatever it was, and going to those shuls. Ironically, those who didn't adopt this idea of it being an issue of copying the non-Jews were, although they had higher mechitzas, they were actually more lenient in terms of going there for a great need. But the bottom line is that you see, according to them, the additional issue over here is that it is a matter of copying non-Jews, which is, again, a prohibition, and that would be an additional factor to keep in mind. The last thing, and this is the idea I want to conclude with, is a quote from Rav Soloveitchik, which I want to quote and unpack. Okay, so he writes as the final source, "The entire concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Prayer means communion with the master of the world, and therefore withdrawal from all and everything. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend, from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. Behold," he's quoting a pasuk, "as the hands of the servants look onto the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maiden onto the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look onto the Lord our God until he be gracious unto us. Clearly the presence of women among men or of men among women, which often evokes a certain frivolity in the group, either in spirit or in behavior, can contribute little to sanctification, to the deepening of religious feeling. Nor can it help instill that mood in which a man must be immersed when he would communicate with the Almighty. Out of the depths have I called thee, O Lord," again another quote, said the psalmist, "such a state of being will not be realized amid family pews." So I'll tell you, I read this many times before, but one event took place that really brought this home for me. And you might have a very different reaction to this event. We were davening in the chapel, it was years and years ago, and there was someone who was, you know, in town. It was during Shiva, there was whatever, some straight, I don't know who they were. And they had a family member who had passed away in Baltimore, so they were in Baltimore, and they were, and this individual, I forgot if it was the man or the woman who just lost their parents, and they were there during Shiva saying Kaddish in the back of our shul. And the man was sitting on one side of the mechitza, his wife was sitting on the other. The mechitza in that room is actually even larger, but still not 56 inches, I don't know, whatever. Okay, bottom line is, he's davening, he comes to Kaddish, and it's, again, it's during Shiva, it's like the first few days of Shiva, you can imagine, the emotions are very heavy, and he starts saying Kaddish, or she starts saying, again, I don't remember which one which, and he starts crying, and it's like, it's very overwhelming, it's like, it's a very moving, you know, moment, and his wife reaches out and like holds his hand to give him support. And on the one hand, it was very touching. It's very, you know, that's what couples do, they give each other support. And at the same time, it's specifically at that moment that I really appreciated what Rav Soloveitchik was saying. Because what he's saying is that the notion of prayer is as best as possible. You know, there's a certain irony. We dive in with a congregation. We need a minyan. We dive in with other, you know, women dive with women and their daughters and their friends, and men dive in with their sons and their brothers and their friends. Fine. But there is a certain spirit that has to be injected into this communal prayer of aloneness. Of aloneness. And that moment of crying, whereas a person could be comforted by their loved one, there's also this notion of allowing ourselves to be comforted by God, which is scary, very scary, but that is really the essence of prayer. Mima makim karasicha Hashem is this notion, yeah, I may have friends, I may, but this notion of I'm all alone, I'm in the depths, I'm in the darkest of places, and there's only one being who could comfort me, and that is God. That is, you know, the awe and the reverence that we're trying to set in a shul is that. That is really the mindset. And so if Soloveitchik is arguing that when there is a husband and a wife, there's the whole family sitting together. Yes, of course, they're still going to have half a family together eventually. We get it. There's a calibration over here. It's not, you know, it's not binary. Like, okay, everyone go in their own cubicle. But the notion of when you're in your family setting, there's a certain comfort. You come into your home. Hopefully, I hope that you feel comfortable. You let your hair down, so to speak, in your home. There's a sense of, you know, you're surrounded by your family. It's a place of, you feel more at ease. And shul is not a place of feeling completely at ease. Shul is a place, you know, I always, you know, I love these, movie theater seating that we have. Always like looking for like the big popcorn holder in our seats over here. My seat's a lot more uncomfortable. You fall asleep in these seats in a second, right? So, you know, I'm not suggesting we sit on benches, but the point is that there's a sense of awe, there's a sense of reverence that sitting on by oneself without one's closest companion engenders, allows for. That's how Soloveitchik understands the frivolity. Not so much about, okay, it's the winking, it's the joking, it's the notion that there is a sense of solitary, you know, aloneness, which to whatever extent we're able to create within a community. You know, Rav Tzadik writes that we have to, when we dive in with everyone else. He says, like, we pretend we're alone as we dive in with everyone else. And the best way to do so, suggests Rav Soloveitchik, says the thinking that what the Gemara is ultimately getting at is that impacts, that takes away from the spirit that is necessary, the awe and reverence, which we've been talking about, which is necessary for shul, it's removed or it's impacted, it's punctured by sitting together with one spouse. That's the notion of mechitza. It's meant to create a place and a sense of awe. That's his argument. That's what he's trying to present. It's a hard idea to appreciate. There's something very comfortable and something beautiful. Many people who sat together with or even during COVID, a person davened at home. Maybe they davened with their spouse. There's something nice about that and comfortable. And it's exactly that. It's so comfortable. And that's not there's a place for that. But it's not exactly what shul is. Shul is a place where it's a little uncomfortable. A shul is a place where we sit a little bit at the edge of our seats. We need to be in a state of awe, an experience, an emotion that we don't normally have the ability to experience. We don't experience awe too often. Shul is supposed to be that place, and you need to separate in order to be able to create that setting. So that's the philosophy of the mechitza, which I think Rav Soloveitchik is getting at. And I think we've learned the different stages, the different, the developments where mechitza entered into our practices. Probably as women started to come to shul, the three different opinions about the sizes of mechitza. Again, a halachic mechitza, 32 inches, 60 inches, a matter of barrier, a more practical barrier, and then not being able to see with nafkaminas, with practical differences. And next week, we will move on to another topic. Have a great day.